Chapter 34, To Europe and Home. Flying from Greece to Rome, I felt that I was going from the philosophical home of the West to the imperial side of it. Ancient Rome was arguably the world's greatest historical empire, a practical people of great organization and accomplishment. The Romans gave us the foundations of our legal precepts and even offered models of government we use to this very day. Italy was also the birthplace of the Renaissance, where the fading values and beauty of Greece and the Roman civilizations were rekindled in more modern times. I slept in an old and inexpensive monastery boarding house in Rome and enjoyed the simple food, table wine, and the ambience of a small wood-raftered room at least 1,200 years old. Perhaps the most moving part of my sojourn was a reverential visit to the Sistine Chapel. I stared upward at the beautiful vision of an Aryan Adam reaching to the European-visaged God, the Father. Much of the Renaissance had Old Testament themes, but the images and stories emphasized were those that meshed more perfectly with the European psyche. And if you take a look at them, the European value of the beauty and strength of the body. Most of the churches had both paintings and sculptures of armored, sword-wielding knights and kings. Michelangelo's St. Peter's Basilica in Rome is far from the Sermon on the Mount and the unwashed proletariat. It is a palace of a higher order of mankind. Its steeples reached to the skies in its times as heroically as Apollo 7 did in ours. Although the early church fought the heresies of heliocentrism, Faustian battles were inevitable, for the people of the Renaissance loved beauty and art, they treasured knowledge, and they revered courage in battle. They were also on a collision course with those who viewed Christianity as a victory of the underclass. Christianity, as expressed in the Italian Renaissance, was a religion focused on a people striving toward their Father in heaven through their courage, their faithfulness, their art, their monumental works, also their self-discipline and incredible devotion to their craft and to the well-being of society. Their continuing of the evolution of mankind to a higher cultural level, as they would say, toward perfection, was their way to communion with God. I thought about whether the plain wood and stone Protestant Reformation was a step back from those aspirations expressed by the Renaissance in such physical power and beauty. I realized that the Reformation's representation in movements such as the Calvinists, and as represented by the Puritans, in fact, in America, were simply a different form of that same Promethean striving, but in the form of an unfettered individual's Siegfried-like test for his own spiritual perfection. They celebrated a will to power over the physical self and the world around them. One part of the Christian faith found its expression in the striving of its art and music and architecture and all the power of its creations. The other, in the disciplined individual, a philosophical vision as stark and hardy as the ice-bound prehistoric landscape from which our ancestors emerged. Walking the streets that were those of ancient Rome filled me with awe of its greatness, a glory that still seemed to be. Its still-living spirit touched my soul. The gens, the Roman founding fathers who built it, still have their genes alive in millions of us. If we but allow it, we can feel their presence and hear their words and deeds echoing in the chambers of our own hearts and minds, resonating in the deepest part of our soul. Circling the Colosseum, brushing my way through the hundreds of cats that now inhabit it, I thought about the sacrifices made by the early Christians for their faith, martyred by felines of a much larger variety. On another day, I visited the ancient Christian catacombs, where the devout hid from the anti-Christian powers, and where so many of the remains still rest. How eerie it is to walk stooped under low-ceiling tombs with hundreds of skulls lined up on shelves like books in a macabre library. I also visited the monument of another kind of martyr, the statue of Victor Bruno, who was burned at the stake for daring to suggest, among other things, that the earth revolved around the sun. I wondered what sacrifices were in store for those who will fight for our new world view, who challenge the orthodoxy of our own day and the inflexible powers of the new world order. While I visited there, I saw some of the members of the Italian MSI, the Italian social movement, and was granted an audience with Signor Amoranti, the leader of the party. I thought it gracious that he took some of his time to talk with a young college student about the issues of the day. He told me, using arguments similar to those of George Lincoln Rockwell, that fascism had much in common with the original government of the United States. He told me that other than the stars and stripes, no other symbol finds more association with early America than the fascist symbol. Being found woven in the original rug of the U.S. Supreme Court and proudly displayed on the interior walls of the United States Congress. He gave me a present of a beautiful gold-edged book, Jefferson and/or Mussolini, written by America's greatest 20th century poet, Ezra Pound. In Amoranti, I felt I had shaken a hand that still had within it the genes that had built the greatness of Rome. From Rome, I went on to Munich. As I stepped off the tarmac, a blast of chilly, late September air made blood rush to my face. It was the first really cool air I had felt since the previous winter in Baton Rouge, and it was wonderful. It is true that sunshine and warmth easily seduce Europeans, probably because our forefathers battled for eons against the cold and wet of the Ice Ages. But nothing can animate and rekindle our spirits like cool temperatures. We do enjoy the brisk air. It was the first time I've been back to Europe since my kindergarten days in Holland, so for me it was almost like a homecoming, since my racial awakening returning to the homeland of our racial ancestors had a very special meaning for me. The soil of Europe is holy, consecrated by the thousands of generations who drew their sustenance from it, and by those millions who defended and nourished it with their blood. The cleanliness of the villages and even the cities, the excellence of the schools, the cultured atmosphere, the magnificence of the Alps, no place on earth is like Europe. I saw beautiful faces everywhere I went, and even the youngest of girls could walk late at night in the streets without any fear. Yes, truly, it is the land of my forefathers. Many of the villages had been a community since even before recorded history, and in spite of a minor language barrier, I felt part of that community, a traveler returned to his homeland after a long absence. I also knew that this was what many parts of America were like before the advent of multiculturalism and diversity, and I realized that when we win our revolution, America will someday be like this again. I visited the concentration camp at Dachau, and I noted that the camp was in the process of important changes. I had read that the camp was an extermination camp containing chambers in which many thousands of Jews had been murdered. But placards had been changed. They now read that it once had a working gas chamber, but that it was, quote, never used. I recalled my reading of the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials documents alleging the gassings at the cow. Not all the exhibits had been changed at the time. Some of them still suggested the mass murder of prisoners. In a restaurant near the camp, I spoke with an old man who told me that his brother, during the American occupation, had been one of the laborers who put in the plumbing for the gas chamber. That's during the American occupation, by the way. I also visited the historical landmarks of National Socialism. In Munich, I went to the very spot where Hitler stood when he addressed his men at the Bürger Braukeller, the hall, since torn down, where the putsch of 1923 began. I visited Braunau and Berchtesgaden, the indescribably beautiful city of Salzburg with its medieval castle overlooking it from the Mönchsberg, a hill rising in the middle of the city. From there I went on to West Berlin and was amazed that so much destruction remained from the Second World War. In front of the ruins of the Reichstag, I talked to a German soldier who knew little of politics, and I felt as though I was talking to a Confederate war veteran during the time of Reconstruction. I told him that the Allies had their share of war guilt, especially the Soviets, but the difference was that the Germans lost the war, and history almost always vilifies the loser. He was amazed that an American would say these things, and he told me of the terrible loss of life in his own family. Among other relatives, he told me he had lost 3 aunts and 7 cousins who were burned to death in the bombing of Cologne. His father, he said, had died in a British POW camp almost a year after the war from the effects of malnutrition and resulting disease, and his mother had gone to the camp every day but had not been allowed to give him the food he needed to live. Even some of his civilian relatives had died from disease in the first few months of occupation when there was no food. "No one cries any tears for them," he said plaintively. "I have," I told him, "and for all the white men, women, and children who died in that terrible war." Seeing the devastation of Berlin and the ugly monstrosity of the Berlin Wall, I grieved again for all our folk who died in that internecine war on both sides of that conflict. I bore no prejudice against the Germans, and I knew other nations bore equal, if not greater, guilt for the physical and genetic devastation of the war. But I felt at that time that Hitler had to bear an especially heavy burden. He had a lot more racial understanding than the other leaders. He should have realized the extreme lengths our traditional enemies would go to incite the war. And he had to know the incalculable damage that such a conflagration would do to our European genotype. He failed in his responsibility to more seriously prepare for the possible conflict, and he could certainly have done far more to avoid it. Although the widened scope of the war was not his intention, as he did not expect the French and English to be drawn into the war with Poland, he had let himself be drawn into it by his own provincial dreams of German glory and Lebensraum. The war left Europe devastated and half of it enslaved. It meant the loss of the British Empire and with it the decline of the entire white world. Even more importantly, it secured an unchallenged Jewish supremacism throughout the European world. Stalingrad was the turning point not only for the Second World War, but also for the white race in the 20th century. More than any other factor, that horrendous war is why Europeans everywhere currently face the terrifying prospect of genetic and cultural genocide. As the century draws to a close, the evolutionary forces of white renewal and renaissance are still crippled by the legacy of the Second World War. After Berlin, I traveled to Great Britain and I met with British activists and then finally boarded the plane for New York, bound for New Orleans. On the plane, I considered the things that had occurred in just the past few weeks, my encounter with the starving Indian child, the close call I had in Israel, and the renewal of my spirit in Greece and later in the heart of Europe. I reviewed what I considered to be the headlong rush of our civilization to disaster and our race to its own genocide. I thought about one of my last days spent in Germany. I had traveled to Detmold and visited the monument to Hermann. His story has to be one of the most triumphant and yet one of the most personally tragic in all of history. It has pertinence for every person of European descent. About the time of Christ, Rome decided to conquer northern Europe. Although it's often said that Rome controlled the entire known world, in reality, there was one part of the world the Roman Caesars knew about but could not conquer. It was Germany beyond the Rhine. One of the largest armies in the history of the Roman Empire, 3 legions under the command of General Quintilius Varus, marched in 7 AD to conquer and garrison the territory. Rome would have succeeded except for the foresight and courage of one man, Hermann, who the Romans called Arminius. Hermann, chief of the Cherusi, a Teutonic tribe inhabiting parts of what is now Germany, was born about 18 BC and served with distinction as a colonel in the Roman army between 1 and 7 AD. He discovered in 6 AD that the Romans planned to conquer his homeland. After resigning his commission, he took it upon himself to organize the Germanic tribes to resist the Roman invasion. Through his commanding physical presence and convincing intellect and spirit, Hermann rallied the chronically feuding German kingdoms to band together and fight the invader. In a brilliant tactical maneuver, he decided to attack the advancing Roman legions led by General Varus in the thickly wooded area called the Teutoburger Wald. He knew that fighting the battle in the thick forest would bring out the superior individual fighting skills of the Germanic warriors and lessen the advantage of Roman tactical expertise and organization. In a great battle lasting for days, the Roman legions were decimated. It was said that Caesar cried in the Roman Senate and plaintively demanded, "Varus, where are my legions? Give me my legions." Tacitus described the great battle in his Annals of History about 100 years later. It was one of the worst military defeats in the history of Rome, and was so severe that although Romans won some battles in the years following, they never were able to conquer the region. Hermann, though, suffered greatly. His pregnant wife's father was Segestes, who betrayed his homeland and his daughter by delivering her to the Romans as a hostage. Caesar paraded her in chains before the streets of Rome. It is said the mistreatment also caused the loss of Hermann's son, who was born in Roman captivity. Other myths or legends have it that his son became the leading gladiator of Rome. Tacitus, in his Annals, quotes Hermann's rousing speech to his fellow countrymen. Here are some excerpts from Tacitus. "Noble the father," he would say, "mighty the general, brave the army, with such strength has carried off one weak woman. Before me, 3 legions, three commanders have fallen, not by treachery, not against pregnant women, but openly against armed men do I wage war. Let Segestes dwell on the conquered bank. If you prefer your fatherland, your ancestors, your ancient life to Roman tyrants and their new colonies, follow me to glory and to freedom, rather than Segestes to ignominious servitude. Standing before the huge statue of Hermon and gazing at his heroic pose of sword pointed to heaven and cape clasped by the ancient symbol of the white race, the sun wheel, I felt again the call of my genes and their demand for courage in the fateful days ahead for the white race. I also thought of an old poem that goes, quote, Hermon was the first, he gathered the brave, the mark of the sun wheel Odin then gave, though blinkered and scabbard away out of sight to Ragnarok sail the glorious fight. I knew the conflict ahead would be for our very survival against the aliens who would wipe away our freedom and heritage. I knew that the decades ahead would be the most crucial in the long history of our race and would demand the same love of freedom and honor that Hermon had shown. I felt I just could not wait any longer and that time was running out for our people. Why finish school and get a college diploma, I thought. It would not greatly affect my level of knowledge. It seemed time to begin my political work. It later turned out to be an error. That was an error that made me more vulnerable to the powers of the establishment. It is my hope, in relating my mistake, that young Aryans reading this will finish their education before embarking full-time in their political work. Get your foundation, get your credentials, and then embark on this vital life's work. My girlfriend, Chloe, finished up her degree in home economics education. She decided to move to New Orleans and teach there. Interestingly, she landed a job in an exclusive college preparatory black Catholic school. I got busy and launched what I conceived as a modern kind of political clan, the National Party, which had racial principles similar to that of the South African National Party. We adapted the clan symbol of the cross wheel and the ancient symbol of Hermon and laid out a racially conscious political program for America that called for an end to third world immigration, a reduction of the welfare illegitimate birth rate, the abolition of so-called affirmative action programs, the ending of forced integration in schools and neighborhoods, the reduction of the size and influence of the government, the breaking up of the Jewish media conglomerates, an America first foreign policy, and more self-determination for both the white and the black race. With little money, a hostile media, and determined opposition from the governmental establishment, we had, as one man remarked to me after a speech, we had as much chance of success as a toothpick in Lake Pontchartrain, unquote. But I believe that the power of truth could overcome all odds. It was just, if just a handful of men would stand up and tell the truth, its power would attract more and more adherents until we would win elections and become the government. I had lots of ideas, a great deal of energy, and a heart that ached for victory. I opened a small office for the National Party at 3214 Dumain Street in a racially mixed New Orleans neighborhood. It was a poor location and a dangerous one. Blacks jumped more than one of our youthful supporters as they walked the two blocks from the bus stop. We lived for days at a time on New Orleans-style red beans and rice. It was all we could afford. But slowly we got support from people in the community who became inspired by our activism and our vision. I began hearing from white activists all over the nation who liked our fresh approach, and we became the largest local white rights group anywhere in the nation, with hundreds of active members and with regular demonstrations and parades participated in by hundreds of people, most of them young. Many of them loved the way we went out and challenged the enemy on their own turf. One of our more exciting forays was against Jerry Rubin, the Yippie leader who was famous for the riots at the Democratic Presidential Convention in Chicago in 1968. Rubin had a reputation as one of the most militant of all the Marxist anti-war advocates in the United States. He openly supported the Viet Cong and openly applauded their killing of American servicemen. Another one of his most well-known lines, which he reiterated at every speech, was, quote, "kill your parents," unquote. Perhaps he meant it rhetorically, but he said it as if he meant it literally. He railed against what he called the system, and he advocated violence against the government and against racists. He spoke in the Cotillion Ballroom at LSU, accompanied by a cadre of beret wearing Marxists. I attended the speech with a dozen of my friends. A question and answer period had been advertised, but when I showed up, the Marxists in charge quickly decided to cancel it. As soon as the speech ended, my friends and I left, angry that we had not gotten the opportunity to challenge Rubin. On our way out, we spotted him near the candy counter in the LSU Union foyer. There he was holding court with his followers. I decided on a strategy unusual for me, but very appropriate for him. I went straight through the crowd and right up to the diminutive Marxist. I put on a scowl, edged up to his face, and said, "You sounded real tough up there on the lectern, talking about killing your parents and smashing the heads of racists and police. Well, let's see how tough you really are. I challenge you any way you want, you commie bastard. A debate or just you and me going at it with our fists. Let's see how tough you are. Right in front of you is what you call a racist and fascist. A live one right in front of you. Do you have the courage, or are you just a sniveling Jewish commie coward?" Rubin's face turned as white as linoleum floor, and without so much as a word, he swiveled around on the soles of his shoes and made a beeline for the back door of the Union. The Marxists who had been so impressed with him 10 minutes before were crestfallen. I jumped up on a concrete planter and told the crowd, which had now grown quite large, that we would hold an impromptu free speech alley on the front steps of the Union. The crowd followed us outside, and I gave them an inspired speech for about half an hour, ridiculing and exposing Jerry Rubin. It was met with much laughter and much applause. I slept very well that night. Our activism brought down to New Orleans some fine patriots from around the nation. One of the first who relocated was Dennis Nix, a well-read and dedicated activist who was an excellent writer and cartoonist of professional caliber, who moved from Missouri. Another young man was Hamilton Barrett, an idealist who brought along a whole series of well-written poems and pieces extolling our heritage and its struggle for survival. The youngest recruit from out of state was Lewis Darne, who came all the way from New York in the service of his race. No one was more devoted or more courageous to the cause than he. Dennis and I worked full time for bare subsistence. He slept on the couch in our 500 square foot office. Hamilton and Lewis worked at regular jobs, but sacrificed almost every cent other than their most immediate needs of food and shelter on getting their organization going. Most of Chloe's teacher pay went into the work as well. Most of the activists came from our high school and college students, as well as young working people. But we had many supporters who were older, and even Jim Lindsay gave a hand when he was not working with his Klan organization. Dennis and I edited and published the Nationalist Monthly magazine and frequently led activities in the streets. We helped organize the white students who proudly attended a white high school named after Confederate General Francis T. Nichols. As the school's population became increasingly black, white students suffered greatly from black violence and criminality. They turned to our group to represent them at the school board meetings where they aired their grievances. The school had a long history and proud tradition, and the students and parents became incensed at the efforts of the blacks to change the school's symbol from the rebels. We picketed with the students on these issues and had a tremendous amount of support from them. We were able to hold off the name change until the school became almost entirely black. We also demanded more law enforcement to halt the rising black crime rate in New Orleans. One of our demonstrations was a torchlight parade scheduled in remembrance of Cynthia LaBeouf, a young white bride-to-be who was raped and murdered by a black assailant. A.I. Botnick, regional head of the ADL, the Jewish Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, had a close working relationship with the New Orleans Police Department. They were able to use the local intelligence section of the police department as their own harassment squad against our organization. They, the FBI, and other plainclothes detectives began showing up at our meetings and taking flash pictures in the face of every person who would attend our public meetings. They tried to get us out of the building on zoning charges. They would look for the slightest infraction on anyone's automobile. They would stop and frisk young people on the street on the way to our headquarters and then threaten them with jail for associating with us. They would go to hotels where we had meetings scheduled and pressure the management to cancel our room contracts. Even more intimidating, they would go sometimes to the places of work of our members, identify themselves as police, and tell the boss that our supporter was under suspicion for crimes and was being watched, and urged them to report any suspicious behavior. It might be hard for the reader to imagine these kinds of operations in a supposedly free nation, but such tactics were even admitted by federal authorities during the congressional COINTELPRO counterintelligence program's investigations that went on before Congress. Federal agents set up COINTELPRO as a dirty tricks operation against those groups of both the political right and left, considered politically subversive, in quotes, of course. One of the more egregious examples of a COINTELPRO-like activity was the planned ambush and murder of white activists in Meridian, Mississippi. Los Angeles Times columnist Jack Anderson exposed it in 1970. A.I. Botnick provided over $37,000 to police agencies to incite Klan activists to violence and then arranged to ambush them in a hail of automatic gunfire. A pretty young white activist teacher, Kathy Ainsworth, who was riding with the Klansmen, was killed in ambush. By the way, this was a Klan not associated with Lindsay or anyone I knew, but these were people over in Mississippi, an independent group. Jack Nelson, in a fine piece of investigative reporting, discovered that the event was essentially a murder for hire committed by the police and FBI for the ADL. Nelson quotes Kenneth Dean, a young civil rights activist in Mississippi, saying that Botnick was asked to, quote, make a contract somewhere in the North to have two Klansmen liquidated. Dean then quotes Botnick as saying, quote, those responsible for the trouble in Mississippi should be killed, unquote. Anderson goes on to report that Botnick told Dean that he could arrange for such liquidation and that there would be no investigation. Police officers are quoted as saying that when they dragged a severely wounded Klansman, Tommy Terrence, from the bushes, they intended to continue shooting him but had to stop because a crowd of neighbors had gathered. Even the liberal Los Angeles Times editorialized against the FBI and the ADL for attempting to act as, quote, Mrs. Ainsworth's judge, jury, and executioner. He went on to say the authorities later discovered Kathy Ainsworth, the only one to die in the trap, was connected to the White Knights, but the police and the FBI found no evidence linking her to any crime. Even after learning that the murdered Mrs. Ainsworth was pregnant at the time, ADL leader A.I. Botnick said, "We were dealing with animals and I would do it again." Anderson was incredulous that a private organization could give money to a public police agency for the express purpose of eliminating an enemy. In the government efforts against me, and we were completely legal and anti-violence in every way, all of my lieutenants and I had clean records, and we'd stressed nonviolence and legality at every opportunity. We preached it to everyone who would come near to us in our organization. The same government that said it was opposed to violence would send in agent provocateurs to encourage violence. FBI and police undercover operatives would infiltrate our organization and then begin suggesting illegal activities. Well, we would not stand for that talk, and we ferreted them out. I knew enough to keep stressing to all our members that we had to be strictly legal because the government was looking for any excuse to shut us down, lock us up, and silence us. The man who arranged for the ambush of Kathy Ainsworth, A.I. Botnick, was headquartered in New Orleans and worked closely with Freddie O'Sullivan, the Jewish head, even with his Irish-sounding name, the Jewish head of the New Orleans Police Intelligence. They were determined to stop my growing organization at all costs. In spite of all the harassment, we kept growing. Our demonstrations were becoming larger, more irritating to our opponents. The scheduled torchlight parade for Cynthia LaBeouf was the largest function we had yet planned. The Wednesday afternoon before the Friday night march, a good supporter, Johnny Schlosser, and I made kerosene lanterns for the parade using a method that the troops used for light in Vietnam and Laos. Kerosene was placed in a thick 7-ounce returnable Coke bottle, just as in a lantern, a kerosene lantern, and a cotton wick inserted in its mouth. A simple kerosene lantern such as this would provide light for hours. We had tested about 3 or 4 of them on the office's front stoop when a police car roared up and asked us what we were doing. I told the officer how we were making lanterns for Friday night's parade. The officer said he saw nothing wrong, but he had orders to watch our office and report everything to the intelligence office. He asked to use our phone. We let him in, and after he told the chief what we were doing, he was instructed to arrest us. The officer protested, but was ordered to take us in. Johnny and I were charged with filling a glass container with flammable liquid. Within minutes, it was reported on the radio news that we were making Molotov cocktails. We were arrested, handcuffed, and hauled down to police headquarters, mugged, sprayed down with insecticide, and separated. I was taken upstairs and put into a 4-man holding cell with 3 blacks. They intentionally locked me up with 3 members of the Black Panther Party. And they were in jail for attacking a white racist candidate for governor, Roswell Thompson, at the Robert E. Lee Monument Circle on St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans. The cell was isolated from any guards. Although I had already talked to James Lindsay and he was posting bail for me, I wondered what I would do until that happened. I decided to give them a talk about Marcus Garvey and black nationalism. They were so stunned that by the time they realized what was going on, I was released. We proceeded ahead and had the parade the next night, and a sizable crowd of about 250 showed up on a rainy, cold evening. I had to get a lawyer for the pending charges, which strained our already small budget. All the charges were dropped when the lab proved that the liquid was kerosene, which was not a Class A flammable liquid as the law specified. I told the press that if I was to be arrested for this, then so should the mayor if he had a bottle of whiskey in his house. Of course, we had no resources to sue the city for false arrest, and the authorities saw the whole episode as a sign that they could do anything they wanted against us, knowing that we had little power to defend ourselves. In spite of continuing harassment, we stepped up our activism by becoming involved with the presidential campaign of George Wallace. George Wallace was shot that spring while campaigning in the Maryland Democratic primary. Although he was not as forthright as we wanted him to be about the race issue, he was the only national politician we could support. We hoped that he would, despite his injury, stay in the race and perhaps run as a third-party candidate. His headquarters certainly kept its lights burning in Montgomery, and we kept our hopes alive. We worked as hard as we could in South Louisiana for George Wallace, and our shipments of materials came marked as the New Orleans Wallace Campaign Headquarters. The national office was shipping us boxes of material every week, and they in turn received a great deal of support from our area. Then one very hot day in June, our world collapsed. The next chapter is chapter 35, In the Belly of the Beast.